Chapter 6.
Frank and I were in the study when Alan and Peter came in looking very much like medieval hermits. They were both stark naked. Well, not quite. Alan was wearing his glasses. He raised his finger with a mad, mad holy gleam in his eye. "Lo, I am the Messiah. I've come down to preach love to the world," said Alan. "We're going to walk through the streets and teach people to stop hating." "Yeah, that sounds like a pretty good idea," said Frank, but he didn't leap from his chair to begin the crusade. "Come with me," Alan said. "We're going out naked to the city streets to tell the people about peace and love. And then we'll get lots of important leaders on a big telephone call to settle all this shit about the bomb once and for all." "Fine," said Frank, "but why don't we do the telephone bit first?" "We're going to call," asked Peter. "Well, we'll call Kerouac on Long Island and Jack Kennedy in Washington and Khrushchev in Moscow and Bill Burroughs in Paris and Norman Mailer and..." "We're going to call first," asked Peter Orlovsky. "Let's start right with Khrushchev," said Alan. "Well, Alan," said Frank in a practical tone of voice, "why don't you start with Kerouac on Long Island?" Alan dialed operator. The two thin figures leaned forward, wrapped in holy fervor to spread peace. Alan and Peter looked as though they'd just stepped out of one of those Italian Quattrocento canvases. They were apostles. They were prophets. They were martyrs. Alan said, "Hello, operator. This is God, G-O-D. I want to talk to Kerouac. Try Capital 7, 0763, Northport, Long Island." There was a pause. We were all listening hard. "No, there's no such number." "Oh, all right," said Alan. "That's the house in New Jersey where I was born. Look, operator, I'll have to go upstairs to get the number. Then I'll call back." Alan and Peter put on robes upstairs. I went to the kitchen and poured water in a kettle. And soon we were sitting around the table talking about the world we hoped we could create. Number one, world peace. Nuclear disarmament. The end to ignorance. Conformity. Unhappiness. It seemed to us that wars, class conflicts, racial tensions, economic exploitation, religious strife, ignorance, prejudice were all caused by narrow social conditioning. Political problems were manifestations of psychological problems, which at bottom seemed to be neurological, hormonal, chemical. If we could help people plug in the empathy circuits of the brain, then positive social change could occur. So, it was then, around the kitchen table, that we started plotting the neurological revolution, moving beyond scientific detachment to social activism. We would no longer be psychologists just collecting data. We would create data. Alan, the quintessential egalitarian, wanted everyone to have the opportunity to take mind-expanding drugs. "Hey," said Alan, "it's the fifth freedom, the right to manage your own nervous system." Our grand plan seemed quite logical. First, we would initiate and train influential Americans in consciousness expansion. They would help us generate a second wave of public opinion to support massive research programs, licensing procedures, training centers in the intelligent use of drugs. It was exactly at this moment, sitting around our kitchen table in Newton, Massachusetts, that we rejected Huxley's elitist perspective and adopted the American, egalitarian, open-to-the-public approach. And thereby hangs this tale.